Jean Piaget was one of the great scholars and scientists of the 20th century. He and Sigmund Freud being the two most important psychologists in the world during that time. He founded an approach that he called genetic epistemology, and we're going to talk today about what genetic epistemology is and what its central concepts are, what some of Piaget's background is, and how the background and the theory go together. We're going to focus on how genetic epistemology grows out of psychology, philosophy, biology, and we're going to talk about the collaborators that Piaget worked with. He was very much a community builder, and especially we're going to focus on the central concepts of action, logic, and stage in his approach and what the main stages are that he outlined. This is a picture of him taken when he spoke in the U.S. at the Jean Piaget Society meetings about 30 years ago. He was a central person in the cognitive revolution that changed the study and understanding of the mind in the last half of the 20th century. One of the two or three people who had the most influence in the field. His basic question is, how do we come to know? How do children come to know as they develop? How do human beings come to know as we develop historically? And this framework that he built focuses on kind of development and historical and evolutionary change as a way of understanding the nature of knowledge. He really grounded the mind in this developmental approach and in the framework that focuses on action as central part of who we are and how we know. So genetic epistemology involves genesis, not genes. Genetic means developmental, in the old meaning that it had before genes were invented and named. So there wasn't any such thing as a gene 100 years ago. And I mean, there was, presumably, but we didn't know about it, and we didn't have a name for it. And back then, genetic meant genesis, meaning developmental. And epistemology is the study of knowledge. So genetic epistemology is the study of the development of knowledge. And epistemology is a field in philosophy. Piaget was very grounded in philosophy, and the whole study of cognitive science is strongly grounded in philosophy at its best. Many of the silly mistakes that we make as cognitive scientists come from not enough grounding in philosophy. Piaget didn't have that problem. He really knew his philosophy. Kant was especially important, the European philosopher Immanuel Kant. Piaget took in Kant's arguments about what the mind was like and how we had to have certain basic ways of knowing in order to make sense of the world. But he transformed it into a developmental approach so that these categories of knowledge, these universals of knowledge, come from acting in the world. Interestingly, also, Piaget's work was really grounded in the approach built by somebody named James Mark Baldwin, who happened to be an American philosopher and psychologist who wrote widely, was very well known at the turn of the century, as well known as William James, had an enormous influence on Piaget. So many of Piaget's central concepts, like assimilation and accommodation, come right out of Baldwin, was trying to do what Piaget eventually succeeded in doing, which was to build this genetic epistemology. Within this approach, then, universals of knowledge are not simply innate. They're not simply environmental. It doesn't make any sense to have an argument about if knowledge is innate or if it's environmental. It's always a combination of the two through the constructive activity of the person as he or she develops. Piaget succeeded in part because he was fabulous at making observations or at recognizing great observations that his students made, ones that were really telling, and they could be used to build research around to unpack how we come to know. The most famous example is conservation. Conservation of amount of liquid or clay or number. There are lots of different kinds of conservations. Probably the most famous of them all is the conservation of liquid, which you see in the diagram, where you have two glasses of orange juice. They're about equal amounts. You then pour one of them into a very different shaped container, in this case a long flat one, and then you ask a child whether it's still the same amount that it was before, whether the two glasses are still the same amount, or whether one of them now has more or less. And most children, before about 6 years of age, will say that one of them has more. The most common in this pair is that the tall glass has more. Though occasionally a child will say that the wide one has more because it's so wide. Basically, the children look at the glasses. They see that one of them looks bigger, and they say that one's bigger. And it takes a kind of logical advance to understand that if it was the same before and all you did was pour it, then it's still the same now. This discovery is one of Puget's most famous, and he immediately in 1939 or 40, around there, recognized its importance when one of his colleagues discovered it. And then build a whole research program around it. The method that he generally used and that he taught his students to use is called the clinical interview. Now, it doesn't mean clinical in the sense that we usually talk about clinical psychology, where we're referring to pathology or psychological problems or therapy. It means clinical in the sense of clinical detachment. You're trying to get a balanced, detached view of the person's competence based on testing them from many different perspectives in many different ways. It's done with a kind of sensitive interviewing in most of Piaget's work. Of course, with infants, you can't do the interviewing. You have to be sensitive in action. But with most of the work involves children who talk and who solve problems, and in the midst of solving the problems and talking about them, you have a sensitive interviewer who carefully tries to probe and change the situation to figure out what children really mean, what they really understand, to get beyond silly mistakes in interpretations or odd wordings that a child might use. Despite the many criticisms of Piaget because he didn't use conventional experimental psychology methods, the real test is whether your findings replicate, and Piaget, with his clinical method, has managed to have hundreds and hundreds of major interesting findings that do indeed replicate. Other people find the same thing when they look for it. So the clinical method is a qualitative method where you're trying to describe a child's understanding based on a sophisticated interview. The goal of it is to relate to the individual child, what she knows, and as it happens, maybe not surprisingly, Piaget was a master interviewer. He was very good at talking with people. It's often said that that the techniques that scientists create have a lot to do with their own talents and their own limitations. For example, Freud was not so good at face-to-face contact. Supposedly, he had trouble looking people in the eye, was a bit uncomfortable, and so, of course, he invented a technique in which the patient lies on a couch and the therapist sits behind him, so there's no face-to-face interaction at all. Piaget, on the other hand, was very good at talking with people. He also had a wonderful, clear French that was quite easy to understand for us disabled Americans trying to speak French. And so he maybe naturally created this very sensitive, effective clinical interviewing technique. It was used and developed initially in his early work, where he focused on interviewing school children and kindergarten children, and in that work, he really emphasized the social foundations of knowledge and perspective taking. Because one of the things that happens when you interview children is that it often becomes very dramatic that they're taking one perspective and that they're struggling with understanding other people's perspectives. Okay, so in the real theory, which didn't emerge until later, was not present early on, in his first five books, he hadn't created his theory yet. It was the sixth and seventh books where he put the theory together. In that theory, there are three central concepts that really help us understand what he was talking about. The first one is action. Now here, an action is a controlled transformation in the world. If you watch the slide, somebody moves the spade with his hand, and that's a transformation. Actions are transformations. Piaget used it in this very general way, so it included motor actions, but it also included any other kind of transformation that we could control, including what we see. You know, you move your eyes to see things. What we hear, we listen for things, and then we hear them better. Transformations in action are the focus of intelligence, according to Piaget. The action involves adaptation. Adaptation is a central concept in biology. Piaget got his doctorate in biology, actually studying mollusks in Swiss lakes for his dissertation. When an adaptation occurs, maybe one of the most dramatic examples which Piaget came back to often is grasping. Here you have a hand grasping a pencil. When you grab a pencil or a bottle, or a computer, each one you have to grab differently, always adapting your hand to the particular object in its particular orientation. So in the same way, knowledge is based on adaptation. When we understand something, we grab it with our mind, and our mind has to adapt to it, just like the hand has to adapt to a pencil. Piaget tried to represent this process in what he called the knowing circle. I've put a version of it here on the diagram. You have a person using a scheme to know. Piaget's word for the structures in our minds was a scheme. The person is knowing an object or an event or another person. So the person applies the scheme to the object, and that involves what Piaget called assimilation. That you're generalizing your scheme by applying it to a new person, a new object, a new event. At the same time, as you're generalizing it in that way, you're particularizing it through accommodation by adapting the scheme to the object. So the scheme affects the object, and the object affects the scheme in a genuine interaction. Sometimes when people talk about assimilation and accommodation, they think that you can have one without the other. You really can't. There's always the two of them. You can have more of a focus on one when you're imitating. You're focusing on adapting to the object. When you're making up a story, you're focusing on your own schemes. Always you're doing some of both. Always there's a balance between the two. That's the process of equilibration that Piaget talked about, with our minds we seek to balance our own understanding with what happens in the world around us, in our actions in the world. So this is very much a relational view, concept. I like to represent it through two hands to emphasize the representational nature of it, that the person and the world are in relationship to each other. That's true if it's another person that you're trying to understand. It's true if it's an object. There's always this relationship between you and something or someone in the world. So that's what action is. Action is, it starts with our movements and perceptions, but it becomes much more general than that, involving transformations that we can do in our minds as well as in the world, and involving this process of equilibration between what we do and the things that we do our activities upon. like to step back now, sort of gotten into this central concept. Hopefully we have a little bit of an idea of what PSA's central framework is, beginning idea at least. Let's talk about his background. He's from Switzerland, French-speaking Switzerland, the province of Neuchâtel. He was born there in 1896. There's some of you have heard of Piaget watches. Everybody always asks if Piaget's had the watch company. No, he didn't have the watch company. His cousins had the watch company. So he had some very wealthy cousins. But his family was highly educated. His father was a professor in Neuchâtel, and he, from a very young age, was an intellectual, actually a prodigy, a child prodigy, publishing his first paper at the age of 12. And then getting an offer to be a curator at a natural history museum when he was still in high school. Actually, when he was still a teenager. He was already starting university work at a very young age. So he lived to be 84, dying in Geneva, where he became a professor for most of his life in 1980. And for over 20 years, he worked on genetic epistemology, starting actually when he was a teenager, when he got caught by the question of knowledge. Really, it became a burning passion for him at a very young age. At this teenage time, he had a religious crisis. His family was fairly religious, especially his mother. They were Protestant Christians, as most people are in Neuchâtel. So he believed at an early age that he knew what was true because of the received truth that comes from the Bible, from God. And then he lost that faith, that meant that he no longer knew what was really true. He became really focused on, obsessed with, how do I know something must be true at an early age? This was a theme throughout his life in genetic epistemology. What leads to necessary truth? How do we know that 5 plus 7 has to equal 12, can equal 11 and a half sometimes, and 27 another time? It always equals 12. For him, logic and mathematics replaced religion starting in these teenage years. As the source of necessary truth. So logic replaced religion, things like symbolic logic with propositions P and Q, things like mathematics with 5 plus 7 equals 12 and 12 minus 7 equals 5. That actually is a problem that Kant used a long time ago. And so if you notice in discussions that are informed by philosophy, that particular problem comes up a lot, and it's just because Kant used it a couple hundred years ago, and everybody keeps using the same problem, 5 plus 7 equals 12. So Piaget, starting at about 15, started building his system. It took him about 20 years to get to the theory that we know now. It started with biology and philosophy. There was hardly any psychology when he was a young man. There were only a couple places in the world that even had psychology laboratories. He wrote the five early books that I mentioned that focused on the clinical interviewing method in school children questions of perspective taking, the child's conception of the world, a moral judgment in the child. Those are a couple of the titles from those five. The book that really begins the full theory, the one that we know today, is The Origins of Intelligence, which is based on work that he and his wife did with their infant children, trying to understand the early origins of intelligence. There were three volumes built that he wrote with her help on these early observations of the children. Origins of Intelligence, Construction of Reality, key phrase there, the construction of reality, and then the development of the symbol in the child, which is translated in English as Play, Dreams, and Imitation. So those three books lay out the theory for the first time. In those books, and in all of his other books, there's just an incredible wealth of observations. Example after example of something a child does, something a child says, that inform the theory, the concepts in the theory. I mentioned that Piaget was a great collaborator. He was a very social person, and he was very good at working with other people in research. Indeed, early in his life, his professional life, he started working with a broad range of people. And one of the characteristics of his work is that he promoted the careers of a number of women when there weren't very many people in the world doing that. So his most important collaborators, about 80% of them are women. Most famous is Berbel Innhelder. Also, Mimi Sinclair, Beauvais, various other people that he collaborated with over the years. They worked very much together at the Center for Genetic Epistemology in Geneva and later at the Department of Psychology and Education in Geneva. There were some less public collaborators that were also important, people that were submerged. There was a bit of a scandal in the late 70s when people realized that several of Piaget's most important collaborators had not been given credit, not much credit. The most dramatic, I think, is his wife, Valentine Piaget, who had been a graduate student working with him and who did most of the observations of infant cognitive development that are in those three books, The Origins of Intelligence, Construction of Reality, and Play, Dreams, and Imitation. She's not given any credit at all, except that the first book was dedicated to her. Alina Zeminska is a Polish psychologist who came to Geneva to get a degree in the midst of the Nazi insanity in Europe before World War II. She was Jewish. She was known in Geneva as being obnoxious. Or unpleasant personality. In that time, she discovered conservation. Piaget picked it up as very important. Berbel Innhelder picked it up as very important. They all started studying it. Then Zeminska, because a bunch of people didn't like her, didn't even get her doctorate, went back to Poland after the war without a doctorate. In the 70s was finally given an honorary doctorate, it was fully acknowledged at that point that she had in fact discovered conservation. Those are a bit sadder stories for Piaget, who was a human being with limitations like all of us. I leave it to you to determine how to balance off his nurturing of a number of colleagues. He's helping them very effectively to build their careers and at the same time he's not being what he should have been with several people, notably his wife and Zeminska. Overall, I think the message is that the building of genetic epistemology was very much a collaboration. Piaget was clearly the leader, but a lot of people contributed to the enterprise. That's really necessary in cognitive science in general. If you're going to bring together behavioral observation, mathematical analysis, philosophy, linguistics, brain science, clearly you have to have collaboration. One person can't know all those things. So the second central idea for Piaget was logic. I mentioned that he initially latched onto logic and mathematics as a way of having necessary truth, of knowing that something had to be true, replacing religion. He then took that insight and he built a model of the development of the mind that said logic was the foundation for our knowledge. that our actions had to be logical in order to build intelligence. This is very much in the French tradition. It goes back for hundreds of years in France that people who were doing work in logic and in mathematics actually said that they were describing the structure of the mind. So Piaget is a kind of culmination of that argument. And for him, logic is a system that's internally consistent, especially it's reversible, and so it avoids contradiction. Reversible just means what it says. It means if you do something, you can undo it. And it's very easy to illustrate it in mathematics. 5 plus 7 equals 12. You want to reverse that? Well, 12 minus 7 equals 5. You get back to your starting point by taking away 7. Piaget said that all logic in intelligence is built on this reversibility property, that it's the kind of essential way that we maintain consistency, always being able to get back to where we started from without contradicting ourselves. So intelligence is the logic of the mind. That gives us consistency in our knowledge. It gives us necessary truth. And reversibility is an essential characteristic of that. This poor guy lost his face because of logic. And in a sense, that's a comment on Piaget. Mostly today I'm just presenting Piaget's view, but a lot of us feel that while logic is an important product of the mind, that the mind isn't actually built on logic. And it's built on something more like a face, kind of an emotional, communicative human organ. So the stage concept. Stages are, for Piaget, mostly convenient ways of describing developmental change. He said that there was major qualitative change in the mind, and if you're going to have qualitative change, you need to be able to describe it. He did, though, go to, take a stronger step towards another meaning of stage, which we'll talk about in a minute. The main stages that he distinguished were the sensory motor, pre-operational, concrete operational, and formal operational. Actually, he also discriminated a bunch of substages within those, and sometimes he only described three stages, or he described only two stages, or he made differentiations within these, like early formal and late formal. So sometimes you end up in his descriptions with more than four, because he was just trying to describe effectively what the nature of qualitative change was. Mostly he talked about four, and generally when you read about Piaget, you hear about these four. The stronger meaning of stage is based on this equilibrium concept, and in particular on the idea that logic creates really strong equilibrium at successive equilibria at different points for different stages. With this reversibility property that we were talking about. I'll illustrate those as we describe the stages that Piaget put forth. In general, this is an epigenetic approach. You know, epigenesis refers to the process of transformation from an egg into a human being, the kind of enormous qualitative change where something becomes something very different from what it started out as. It's an amazing process, as many of us know, having being or having recently become parents. It's an epigenetic approach. In general, a skill or a scheme is transformed from one kind of structure into another. For each of the major stages that Piaget is talking about. So there are four periods, and if you try to diagram them all in terms of this kind of qualitative metaphor of geometric shapes, you see each one is qualitatively different from the others. At each time you build a stage, you get a qualitatively different structure or organization. A lot of Piaget's achievement was describing what those organizations are or might be. he was the first person to really give a coherent description of what each of the stages entailed, how it was organized, what its structure was. Sensory-motor intelligence, the first one, this is for some people the hardest one to understand because it's pre-verbal. It involves logic in action and perception. That's why it's called sensory-motor. So we have actions of grasping and kicking and walking and talking. We have perceptions of looking and listening, not just seeing and hearing, but looking and listening. There's an active view. In general, other people have tried to take Piaget's work and apply it to other animals, and a broad conclusion from that work is that mammals and many birds have some kind of sensory-motor intelligence, kind of like human infants, except specialized for their species. If you think about a teddy bear, how does a child come to know a teddy bear? This is a way of getting a little bit of a brief handle on what sensory-motor intelligence is. Among other things, you can grasp a teddy bear, and you can look at a teddy bear. You can also feel how it is when it's in your lap or when you hug it. You can do a lot of different actions to a teddy bear, and the infant comes to understand what a teddy bear is by combining all of those actions. And so gradually building up an understanding of a teddy bear. Same for mom. You can grab mom. You can look at mom. You can nurse with mom. You can get hugged by mom or tickled by mom. You can yell at mom, cry so she'll come. There are a whole bunch of things that you do to objects and people to understand them based on your actions and perceptions. In pre-operational intelligence, infants build on these complex action systems to internalize their actions and perceptions. Piaget called those internalizations representations. So we come to be able to represent, I see, mommy sees, mommy talks, a bunch of different representations. They include speech, they include pretend play, in play, dreams, and imitation. There's a description of a lot of the different kinds of representations that emerge during the preschool years. There are also early images, which Piaget called internalized imitations, which are not very good images in the child by the kind of logical criteria. Though in some ways children can have really good images. Piaget didn't study that, but there's something called eidetic imagery which young children are much more likely to have than adults. It tends to go away with time, which is something like a capturing of an object the way it really looks or the way it really sounds instead of a kind of logical analysis of it or conceptual analysis. So examples of representations are saying pick up Teddy, saying see Teddy, making Teddy walk or eat or talk, pretending that Teddy's alive, or picturing or imitating Teddy in your mind. All of those develop at about 2 years of age and get elaborated during the preschool years, during the what Piaget called the pre-operational period. The third period is the concrete operational period. That's the first time the child develops a logic in representation. The pre-operational period is illogical, according to Piaget. It's the kind of prototype for not being logical. In the concrete operational period that starts at about 6 or 7 years, you have real arithmetic developing. So the kind of arithmetic problems that we've been using are actually things the child does and understands. You see, I've changed it here to 5 plus 9 equals 14. Yeah, got tired of 5 plus 7 equals 12. So 14 minus 9 equals 5 reverses that. And children really can understand how to do the operation of addition, how to do the operation of subtraction. They can gradually understand that the subtraction reverses the addition. So they actually come to be able to do these logical operations that Piaget's been talking about, and those are examples of concrete operations. They can only do it with concrete numbers. During these early years, they can't do it more abstractly. That comes later. Two examples that Piaget used a lot of concrete operations, where he did extensive research with Inhelder and Zeminska and other people, are multiplication of classes and conservation. In multiplication of classes, you have a dimension of shapes of objects, for example, and a second dimension, which might be color of objects, in a kind of standard toy block sorting game. You've got colors and shapes. The shapes would be triangles, squares, and circles. The colors would be red, blue, and yellow. And that builds a multiplication table for classes. Right? You multiply shapes by colors, and you get 9 different, in this case, colored shaped objects. Red triangles, blue triangles, red squares, yellow squares, etc. So in concrete operations, children can really understand this concrete multiplication of classes. So they can build that kind of table and play with it and master it. They do something similar for amounts, like number or quantity of orange juice. For the standard conservation task, you've got the kind of height. I'm sorry, that's width and height. When the height and width compensate for each other, then you have equal amounts. When they don't compensate for each other, you have unequal amounts. And of course, the multiplication table can be much more than just two categories. It can involve narrow, medium, and wide, for example, just to make it 3 categories. It's down the middle, generally, where conservation occurs, down the diagonal, where you have one dimension compensating for the other. That kind of compensation is what's understood in conservation. Piaget talked about it in terms of this kind of multiplication of relations or amounts. Multiplication of classes, multiplication of relations are two of the concrete operational structures that Piaget described and studied. I hope you see that in all of those, because you can move around in this table, you can make a change and then compensate for it. Go back, reverse, go back to where you started from. Now, in formal operational intelligence, the reversibility becomes infinite, because now you have a logic of the hypothetical, of the abstract, of the possible. It's based in what Piaget calls operations on operations. So you have an operation on a concrete operation, and that makes it a hypothetical or abstract operation. The example I like the best, Piaget didn't study very much, so he mentioned it, that is that in mathematics you have the concept of a variable like x, and that's an unknown operation. So in a sense, it requires operations on operations to understand a variable, because you have a bunch of different operations that can go in there. And certainly when you start relating one variable to another, then it becomes a number of operations coordinated with each other through operations on them. Piaget's favorite, or one of his favorite examples of formal operations, was all possible combinations. That's because that is an important thing to be able to do in scientific reasoning. If you want to figure out what factors produce a certain outcome, like when you put chemicals together and you get a certain color produced, you have to figure out which combinations produce that color. To do that, you need to figure out what all the possible combinations are of the chemicals. There are a whole lot of tasks where this applies. one of the most basic and simplest to test with children is one where you take objects like coins or buttons or dolls that differ. You've got, it's easy to do with coins. You've got a bunch of pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters. I misspelled nickel, sorry. You just go systematically through them, figuring out what are the possible combinations of those four coins, taken one at a time, taken two at a time, taken three at a time, taken four at a time. To do that, you have to build a systematic table to figure out what combinations have been done and which ones haven't, which is a way of operating on concrete operations of combining coins. So if you do it by trial and error, which most 8-year-olds don't do even this kind of concrete task well. When I was first studying PJ, like many people, I was skeptical about a lot of these observations. So, you know, I went out with some kids and I asked them to make combinations of things, and they did just what he said. This is the replicability I mentioned before. They would just kind of pick out combinations that they happened to notice and never put them all together to make sure they had all possible combinations. So you'd end up with a string of concrete combinations that they happened to have come up with, but they'd never get all possible combinations. Another example of an operation on an operation is in kind of propositional thinking. There are many examples you could use. This is something where you have a proposition about a fossil discovery. Yesterday, scientists found a 3-year-old skull of an animal with 5 feet and 2 heads that died 100 years ago. Most 8-year-olds will say, well, that can't be true because there aren't any animals with 5 feet and 2 heads. Okay? But if you look at it logically, like a formal operational child can do, then you can see there's a contradiction in it. You can't be 3 years old and if you died 100 years ago. So that's another example of an operation on an operation. In general, each of the stages, or most of the stages, provide a strong equilibrium. The reason Piaget defined them as stages is that they reach an equilibrium according to his analysis. And he described what each of those equilibria are in quite a bit of detail with treatises on mathematics and logic of intelligence, most of which haven't been translated into English, but they're still available in French and quite interesting. For the sensory motor period, it's a logic of action. The child can undo whatever she does. So if she hides an object, then she can find it under the hidden screen. If she moves across the room, she can get back to where she started through a number of different pathways. Each of those is an example of reversibility in action that Piaget studied. For the pre-operational period, he said there is no logic. There's at best a semi-logic late during the time. He used it as a prototype of the kind of illogical, irrational Freudian child. The concrete operational period involves the logic of the concrete experienced world, as I tried to show in some examples, and the formal operational period, the logic of the hypothetical, abstract, formal world of knowledge of the world. Piaget tried to take all of this and put it into a model that he called equilibration, a very general model of how we worked in the world, moved towards the equilibria through assimilation and accommodation and through several other models that he tried. A lot of people were very unsatisfied with those models. They found them very fuzzy. And a lot of people dismiss them, especially Americans or other English-speaking psychologists who have such a focus on a kind of hard-nosed empiricism a lot of the time. It's actually, equilibration is coming back in a fairly big way because the tools of nonlinear dynamic systems, which are more sophisticated mathematical tools than we used to have, which have just been developed, many of them, over the last 20 or 25 years, especially helped along by computers. With those tools, you can actually start to study models of equilibration quite rigorously. And there have been a number of people who have been trying to do that. A lot of them are in Europe, actually. I've listed a couple of the best ones here. Paul van Geert has built a general system for modeling growth, which we use sometimes, and has actually taken the equilibration model that Piaget built, added a few insights from other people like Vygotsky, and then looked to see what its properties were. And has some very interesting properties, a lot like what Piaget hypothesized, to van Geert's surprise. Van der Maas and Molinar have suggested that catastrophe theory, which is one of the complicated mathematics in nonlinear dynamics, is a good model for the way the mind develops, in particular how it changes in a stage-like way. In nonlinear dynamics, you have these kinds of complicated growth curves, the processes of equilibration lead, at the simplest, to a kind of a stable state under some circumstances. That's the kind of thing Piaget was talking about. Overall, then, Piaget is one of the great figures in the history of the behavioral sciences, one of the founders of cognitive science. He created an approach that he called genetic epistemology, where he tried to integrate philosophy with development, biology, and psychology of development. To do so, he built a large collaborative community in Europe, including sometimes us North Americans, though at times he was annoyed with North Americans because we always seem to ask the same question, how can you speed it up? He named that the American question. He didn't think it was a good idea to speed it up most of the time, speed up development. He argued that cognition is based in activity, that there's an equilibration between the person and the world through activity, and that that forms the basis of intelligence which reaches its best, most equilibrated forms in logic and mathematics. And he described a series of stages, epigenetic stages, that intelligence develops through in moving towards being able to create mathematics and science and logic.